You're listening to the Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Dr. Nina Show here on LA Talk Radio. I am your host, Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, and I am here to help you stop binging, stop body shame, and stop being on diets that don't work. Boy, did I mangle that intro, but I did it right the first time when it wasn't recorded. I'm here to help you break free from body shame, binging, and diets that don't work. I want you to wake up and think about your day, not your diet. If you would like to join me, if you have any questions, Josh has already dropped a question, or you can call in. The number is 323-203-0815. 323-203-0815. I would love to hear what is on your mind, what is eating at you, because the real problem with binge eating, stress eating, and any kind of emotional eating, the real problem is not food. It is what's eating at you. It's not what you're eating, it's why. Carly Gash, I saw Josh's question in my comment. Maybe you don't see what I see on my phone, but he asked a comment about I don't know why you don't see that. But anyway, technical issues today, guys. Technical issues. So Josh asked a comment about my experience in analysis, which is different from my experience in therapy. I considered myself the poster child for eating disorders, and I had all of them. If you look at my teenage journal, every page is filled with numbers: calories I ate, calories I burned, the weight I was going to be. And I was always on some crazy restrictive diet. And eventually my willpower would fail and I would eat the kitchen. And sometimes I would purge. And that's why I was the poster child for eating disorders. I had all of them. And in college, I finally went to therapy for anxiety. So I talked about guys and goals and dreams and fears. And I was open with my therapist about every part of my life except one. I never told her what was going on with food. Never. Because I was too ashamed. I was like too mortified. So nobody knew the truth. But by the time eating disorder behaviors were gone, and people say, well, like, how is that possible? How do you stop being the poster child for eating disorders without ever talking about food? And that's because in therapy, I learned that food was not the problem. Not the problem. Food was the solution to the problem. The problem was my mean relationship with myself. And when I started being kinder to myself, when I stopped criticizing myself and started being curious, when I stopped tearing myself down and started encouraging myself, everything changed. So I stopped being the poster child for eating disorders because I turned my inner critic into a friend. Thank you, Carly Gash, for that very kind comment you were leaving. So Josh, disorders without ever talking about food. When I was in my doctoral program and I was in analysis, you know, I did not talk about it there because it was no longer a problem. It had been resolved earlier. And by then I was already a therapist helping people with eating disorders. And that is actually a really good segue into the topic that I wanted to discuss today, which is I got a question from a woman named Kennedy. How cool is that name? Kennedy, you have one cool name. She said, you've said binging is a way of helping. Other than comfort food, how does it really help? You know, that is a great question. Josh, no, I never got any direct help with eating. Never once discussed it. Never once talked about it. Not once, not a single time ever. This is a thing that in my TEDx talk this weekend, April 3rd, 2022 at UC Santa Barbara. So if you're going to be in the LA or Santa Barbara area, come check it out. It's going to be me and a bunch of other like really awesome speakers. It's going to be wonderful. So if you can get to UC Santa Barbara on Sunday, April 3rd, between 1 and 4, come say hello and listen to me and also some other wonderful TEDx speakers. So Kennedy, your question is very good. And let me give you some examples of how binge eating or other eating disorders actually help. And then I'm going to go into it with a little more detail. So yes, it can be a source of comfort. It can also be, so that's about self-soothing and dissociating from painful or upsetting affects. It can be a way of, we don't have enough of certain things, we can't get it. And so, you know, what is one thing that you can actually get more of? Food, anytime. You may not be able to get love. You may not be able to get money. You may not be able to get more friends. You may not, you know, immediately in the moment, you may not be able to get more of what you want, a better job, a partner, a better partner, whatever it is. You may not be able to get more of something, but you can get more of food. And so unconsciously, that is a way of being able to express both the wish and the, and meeting that wish or more of something in your life. It could be a way of managing objectification. I'm going to go through this all in more detail later. It can be a way of converting emotional pain to physical pain. When we eat much that starts, you know, people have said to me so many times, like, why can't I stop eating? I'm in pain. Like, I'm such an addict. No, you're not an addict. You are converting emotional pain to physical pain, because physical pain is easier to resolve than emotional pain. It can symbolically fill a void. If we're lonely, if we're empty, if there's something missing in our lives, if we have a void in our lives, some kind of holes in our lives, in our souls, then food, which takes up space within us, is a way of symbolically filling that void. It's also a way of managing. This is the one everyone looks at me like, what are you talking about? It's a way of managing a fear of happiness. On this, ridiculous. Why would I be afraid of being happy? I want to be happy. People tell me all the time, I'm going to be happy when I'm thinner. I'm going to be happy when I stop binging. I'm going to be happy when fill in the blank. Well, what if we also have an idea in our minds that with happiness, the other shoe's going to drop, right? Oh, you can't be too happy. It was too good to be true. The other shoe's going to drop. The rug's going to be pulled out from underneath you. Look at all the ways that our culture tells us that being happy is just a setup for some bad thing that's going to happen next. What better way to manage that than to never be, quote unquote, too happy? Hey, Sean, glad to see you. I'm seeing my friends on Instagram. Woohoo. Feel safe. If you're never too happy, nothing bad is going to happen to you. And so if you never are happy about your weight or your appearance, or if you're unhappy because you can't stop binging, and by the way, this is such an important point, not everybody who binge eats is overweight. You can't tell if someone has an eating disorder by looking at them. Just a side point, which has come up recently. So if you're not too happy, you're safe. If you're always a little upset because you're of your weight, or a little upset or a lot upset because of your binging, then you're safe. If you on some level think that happiness is going to lead to unhappiness. So let me give an example. Oh, and one more thing. Why comfort? Why food? Talk about comfort food. We are actually really talking about a wish to be comforted by somebody else. But people can be unreliable, unavailable, and unpredictable. Food, which on some level represents relationship, food is reliable, available, and predictable. So we might turn to food for comfort instead of to people. So that's why That's why we have such a thing as comfort eating, but that's just part of it. That's just the obvious. All the other things that I talked about are much more, important, really. So let me give you an example. I have an example. I want to read from my book. This is from my book, Beyond the Primal Addiction. And I had it all ready to go, but because today is that day where everything's going funky. All right, no, I've got it. Here it is. All right, so this is about being hungry for love. And I'm going to tell you about Arlene. Arlene began treatment when she was in her late 30s, hoping to overcome what she called her donut addiction. She was raised in a strict Catholic family. And by the way, I should say that Arlene is not her real name, and some of these details have been slightly altered. So, she was raised in a very strict Catholic family. She was the oldest of 8 kids. And during her childhood, she was expected to help her mother take care of all the younger children. And her siblings were known as the kids, as if Arlene wasn't one of the kids. And Arlene always felt her place in the family was more like a second daughter, like a second mom thing. Her mom said that leaning on anyone, depending on anyone, that was a sign of weakness. And she really was very adamant that you should never depend on anyone. Be independent. And yet she openly relied on Arlene's help for childcare, house cleaning, and more. So Arlene found this like do as I say, not as I do kind of philosophy to be very confusing. She was also not close to her father, who died in a car accident when she was in high school. And before he died, he'd been kind of an absent figure in her life. He was a businessman. He traveled a lot. And when he came home, he went straight to his study to relax and unwind. So she had this parent that she didn't really connect with. Every weekend, he left early for the golf course and returned home for dinner. And she, don't bother your father. He needs to rest. And so they had relatively little interaction with him. They also learned that somehow their presence was going to be a bother, which is interesting, isn't it? So Arlene's strongest memory of her father was that he constantly drank root beer, which he referred to as mother's milk. After he died, Arlene longed for even more of her mother's love and acceptance. Yet she always felt that she felt short, that she fell short of her mother's expectations. And she interpreted that as meaning that she didn't deserve her mother's love. She just somehow wasn't good enough. She wasn't doing enough. There was something about her that just wasn't enough. The family focus was on achievement. And the message was that, quote unquote, negative emotions such as anxiety were not tolerated. Side note, there are no negative emotions. There are no positive emotions. When we say, oh, that's a negative emotion, what we're really saying is it's difficult or painful to experience. But the problem is then we think we're being negative when we have painful feelings. No, we're not being negative. We're just experiencing something that's difficult. So Arlene recalled that her mother got annoyed whenever anyone was sick. Illness appeared to be both an inconvenience and an indication of basic weakness. If Arlene had a fever and complained, her mother would say, "Quit your belly aching." No matter what Arlene did, it was never enough. If she brought home good grades, she was asked why they were not better. Why had she not done extra credit? Why was she not the top of her class? She recalled never feeling as if feelings about this lack of acknowledgement and lack of love. Arlene, no surprise, married young to get out of the house, and she immediately got pregnant. And shortly after she gave birth to her first child, she began this intense craving for donuts. She regularly bought a baker's dozen and would sit in her car alone, stuffing donuts into her mouth, unable to stop. Josh, I'm going to finish this and then I'll be right with you, okay? Often with tears running down her cheeks. She was disgusted by her perceived lack of control, and over the ensuing years, she managed this so-called weakness by going on a series of stringent diets. Inevitably, her willpower failed, and she found herself driving to Krispy Kreme. Sometimes she bought only the donut holes, but they failed to satisfy her craving. Yeah. Josh, again, I see you waiting there. I'm going to be with you. I just don't want to stop my momentum. So hold on.
That's fine. Literally, I don't know if you can hear me.
Arlene's identification with her mother was apparent from the beginning of our work, when she shared how ashamed she was for bellyaching about things that upset her. Becoming a mom had triggered this deep hunger for mothering, which is when this donut addiction, quote unquote, donut addiction began. And as we worked through many of those identifications and wishes, the symbolism of the donuts became clear. Donuts have a missing piece at the center, representing the missing piece at the center of her mother. She had a mother, but not a mommy. Big difference. A mother, but not a mommy. The sweet, sugary donuts were her way of incorporating, complete with the missing piece. By their very design, donuts conveyed the presence of an absence. As our treatment progressed, so did the nature of Arlene's addiction, quote-unquote addiction, to donuts. She developed a thing for cream-filled donuts, and she only bought two at a time instead of a baker's dozen. One day, she bit into a cream-filled donut and, to her dismay, realized the cream was missing. She got really upset and couldn't figure out why she was so upset and angry. But she felt as if she'd somehow been, like, super cheated. She was really upset. So she went back to the donut shop, but they were out of white cream-filled donuts. They only had chocolate-filled donuts. She said, no, I didn't want those. I wanted the white cream. I wanted that cream. And she's like, I wanted that cream filling. Notice where my hands are. I really wanted it. So she was holding her hands out in front of her chest and moving them back and forth. I really wanted it. And I was struck by the way her hands were cupped as if to form the shape of, like, breasts, right? And I suggested that the two cream-filled donuts represented the full, what she never got from her mother, mothering, a version of mother's milk that she could actually take in. And this really resonated with her, who said that she had shifted from symbolically focusing on what wasn't there, the donut holes in the donuts, to craving something tangible and filling. So unfortunately, just as there was no cream in those cream-filled donuts, there was no mother for her to take in. So that is an example of it's in the unconscious, but it really shows how our deepest hungers can show up with food in different ways. Okay, Josh, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Not much. I just wanted to say congratulations and good luck on your TED Talk. I guess that's going to be this weekend, so that's great. And I imagine you've already written it. I just wanted to say that how amazing that is. And
thank you. Well, if I hadn't written it, I would be in big trouble. But yes, I have written it.
Yeah, so you've written it and you've practiced it and everything. Because you have to do it without notes, right?
You have to do it without notes, yes. Believe me, I can do it in my sleep. Yes. My family is very sick of hearing my TEDx talk. But thank you.
Can you give us a little snot?
I can't give you a taste, but I can give you the title, which is the title.
Okay,
the title is Why Binge Eating is Not About Food.
Why Binge Eating is Not About Food?
That's it. Why Binge Eating is Not About Food.
And I was actually asking the question whether or not it was interesting that you actually never really talked about food with the therapist, but you talked about everything else. And as a result of talking about everything else, suddenly your food issue went away, which is so interesting. It means that it was just emotional work that you were doing or whatever, and that was enough to fix it, which is just amazing.
It wasn't that I talked about everything else. It was that my therapist made me see that I was very hard on myself. I was a perfectionist. I was self-critical. Nothing. If I were skinnier, I'd be good enough, kind of a thing. And then in therapy, by realizing this and recognizing that I was super harsh to myself, I started being nicer to myself. And that was the key, because when we are able to comfort ourselves, support ourselves, and, you know, encourage and reassure ourselves, respond to ourselves, we don't need food or anything else to escape ourselves or numb or distract or enact. So it wasn't that I talked about other stuff. It was that I came to realize that I was that my own toxic, mean inner mean girl was the problem, not, and food was the solution to the problem.
And I imagine that that's basically the meat of your talk. I would have to confirm, did not. And I know that that's somehow that's how psychoanalysis works, without getting into the theory of it, is that, you know, if an alcoholic comes, they don't have to talk about alcohol. They talk about everything else, and sort of the alcoholism goes away. Is that right or wrong, or am I on the right track?
Absolutely. There's this erroneous belief that there's something in our brains. A colleague of mine noticed that people started feeling better, who studied alcoholism, started noticing that Lance Dodas, who's written a couple of books on addiction and how to get over addiction, he's a psychoanalyst. He started noticing that people, when they started planning what they were going to drink, they started feeling better. So planning it, now they weren't drinking, but just the idea of planning, I'm going to go home and I'm going to open that bottle of whatever and eat that. It's not just the alcohol per se. It's the psychology of it as well. Oh, I'm going to be giving myself something that's going to provide relief.
Yeah. I feel like what you're doing is even more than Lance Dodds doing, because you're doing it to a public, you're doing it to a popular audience. You know, TED Talk is a popular audience. It's not a Harvard lecture to faculty and, you know, staff, or, you know, I'm not saying that Lance Dodds didn't, you know, he's been on, you know, NBC, and he's been on the major networks talking about Trump, about how Trump is a malignant narcissist. But I feel like what you're doing is really interesting, that you're taking psychoanalysis to a public, to a popular audience, which is interesting.
But, yeah, well, we thank you. We have this idea, you know, when I say, you know, Freud, people imagine this like stern, cold, silent person. And the reality was, just as an aside, Freud was nothing like that. You know, he was very warm and caring and helpful and engaging. And it was the American analyst in the 50s that kind of took on that like stern way of that cold kind of don't talk in therapy. And that's old school psychoanalysis. Psychoanalysis is really about, it's really about recognizing the hidden reasons why we do the things that we don't want to do, or why we're not doing something we want to do, or why we're doing something we don't want to do. It doesn't make sense. It's not logical. It is psychological, and it is often hidden from us in our unconscious minds. So when we can bring consciousness and see, it's the weed and the root, right? We can't get rid of a weed without digging out the root. The root, we don't see the root. It's hidden in the ground. It's in the dark. Similarly, there are hidden parts of our minds, our unconscious minds, that are hidden from us, yet they have so much to do with the behavior that we feel so confused about.
Yeah, I mean, obviously you've been analyzed for 5 years or whatever, 5 times a week. And so you're not worried about your public speaking at the TED Talk. You're not having crazy anxiety. You're not having, you're not losing your mind for this. You're not having any fear of success, it sounds like.
No, but let me be candid. Look, I would be lying if I said, yeah, I just can't wait to get in front of 500 people. Of course, it's a little anxiety producing. That's normal. Of course. It's just what we do with that anxiety. that is the difference. It's being able to respond to that anxiety and say, yeah, of course I'm anxious. It's, you know, I'll do vary on myself, right? Vary. How do you comfort yourself? You vary your response. Well, of course I'm feeling a little anxious. It's a big deal. It's kind of intimidating. It's a little scary. Of course I feel anxious. How could I not? That's validate and acknowledge and reassure. I am prepared. I am ready. I believe 1000% in what I am saying, and I'm excited to bring my message to a greater audience. So, yeah. So it's both a little intimidating and anxiety producing and exciting. That's normal.
It's not. Yes. So what I would say to that is, based on the unconscious, you're not going to be conscious of your anxiety. And so what I mean by that is, maybe on the way to the TED Talk, you get a flat tire, or maybe you hit someone's car, or maybe you forget your purse, or maybe you know, all these unconscious things that can sabotage us.
No, what you're conscious of and what you're aware of, it you're aware of it. But for example, this is not me, it's someone else. It's like someone who is always being objectified, for example, would be anxious about, they think they're anxious about speaking, but really they're re-experiencing this fear of being looked at, objectified, and found wanting. So they're consciously aware of the situation in the present, but they may not be aware of the past situations that are causing them to feel that way.
Right. So in the case of the person who's on the way to the TED Talk who forgets his wallet, or, you know, I mean, this is in Stephen Gross's book, Examine Life. You know, the guy gets a new job and he leaves his wallet on the subway, and then he forgets to call. And then the person says, "Oh, I've got your wallet." And he checks his pockets, even though the person told him he had the wallet. And the whole idea with this guy was, just very, very briefly, was that he was afraid of losing his parents, that the success caused him so much grief about losing mom and dad, that he had these neurotic breakdowns right before his huge success.
Yes. And that is an excellent book, The Examine Life. But just getting back to how that relates to food issues, if we don't know how to respond to ourselves, comfort ourselves, be with ourselves, then of course we're going to find something to help us cope by escaping, numbing, whatever. Something other were there when I was talking about the very different ways that food helps, because Kennedy asked, Kennedy said, well, it helps for comforting, but what else does it do? Well, it does a whole lot. It's a way of expressing something. So if you're eating so much that your stomach hurts, then that's a clue that you are turning emotional pain into physical pain. What a background noise, gosh. That tells you that you need to look at what is the emotional pain that you may be denying but expressing through food. So it's about being a detective, like you've heard me say, be a detective of the mind.
Yeah, so I just want to wish you good luck. And I think that, you know, obviously, you know, what I would say about the TED Talk is that maybe I'm not saying you would be conscious of their feelings concerning an event like that or a public recognition of that. And so, but the feelings are there, but the person isn't conscious of what the feelings that the success brings up in the person. And most often it's loss. It's a sense of loss. This is what Steve Gross said, is that we don't realize that our successes are lost.
No, Josh. No, most often. For some people, yes. For other people, no. Everyone is an individual. And some people are afraid of success for certain reasons, and some people are afraid of success for other reasons. And so, you know, be very aware of it of the it's most often, it's always. Everybody is an individual, and everybody has developed their relationship to themselves and to food for reasons that are as unique as they are. And so really looking at why that person or why you are in the conflict that you are in, instead of trying to fit yourself into some box of everybody, or thinking that everybody has a certain way of being.
Yeah, I really like that. So I just want to wish you the best, and I guess we'll be able to watch it on YouTube, right?
Absolutely. I will be sharing it. You bet I will.
So I think they say in show business, they say in show business, break a leg, you know, and I think there's something interesting in that psychologically.
Yes, I wonder where that came from. Well, find out where that expression came from. I'm curious. Anyone know?
Well, I think it says something about, well, if you're so nervous, you know, break a leg. Now you're not nervous because you're not breaking your leg, are you? You know what I mean?
Okay. All right. When you break a leg, then you're just focused on the pain of your leg, and you're not focused on your anxiety. Got it. Right.
Exactly. In other words, there's nothing to be afraid of.
Which is what food does, right? Which is what binging does. If you are focused on what you're binging and how you feel and what you weigh, you're not thinking about other things like, oh, I'm not satisfied in this area of my life, or I feel sad or upset or angry about this or that, or I'm mad at my partner, or I, you know, whatever. I wish I had a better this or a different that, or I'm missing, right? It distracts your mind. So great analogy.
Yep,
thank you.
Sounds good.
The genesis of that, and I really appreciate your good wishes.
Oh yeah, and I would just say, you know, we never are aware of our unconscious conflicts, and that's what makes life so fun and interesting.
But we can become aware of it, and that's where change happens.
We'll talk next week.
Okay, Josh, take good care. Stay curious.
Okay, bye bye.
Bye bye.
Yes, will do. Bye bye.
Okay. So I have another, example of how food can express like a hunger for love, a hunger for more. Food represents relationship. Food represents people in our psyche, in our unconscious mind. We don't consciously think of it that way, but the whole reason that we are drawn to food is because our first experience of being fed was the experience also of being connected to another person, feeling kind of a safety and a bliss and a care that we yearn on some level to re-experience. Okay, so Jane had been changed. So Jane grew up in a chaotic household dominated by a father who was prone to alcoholic rages and a mother who alternated verbal and physical hostility with expressions of concern. I also wrote about Jane in my first book, Food for Thought. So I said I've written elsewhere about Jane, who was overweight as a child and developed anorexia in her teens. She came to treatment when she was in her late 20s, and she was living 1,000 miles away from her family. And shortly after being fired from a job where she felt like we were a family, she started eating relentlessly. Losing the job created this intense hunger for connection. She was starving for something relational, but she turned to food instead of people for the reasons that I explained earlier. She ate so much food that when she recounted the details of her binges, I felt physically sick. And I've heard about binging for 20 years. So for me to feel physically sick was something, right? And my reaction revealed her unconscious wish to be a little intrusive with me, as well as to convey the horror of her childhood. So I sort of felt in some ways what she felt. And she said that her binges were made up of foods that she did not actually like. She was, as she put it, addicted to peanut butter, but she said she actually did not like peanut butter at all, although it was one of her mother's favorite foods. She often mentioned the calorie counts of various foods. Like she always had a cookies that were 135 calories each, or she said, oh, I had 100 grams of cheese. She would not stop binging until she gained 135 pounds. Not coincidentally, this was the exact weight of her mother, 135 pounds. By gaining 135 pounds, Jane was like recreating her mother, like the ultimate merger. I know this sounds really strange, but bear with me. It was like if she had 135 pounds extra that represented her mother in some way, this was her victory over any separation from her mother. So losing weight was like losing her bond with her mother. And this was so terrifying to Jane that she couldn't stop eating, because to stop eating and lose weight, again, meant losing that internal bond. So she used food as a way of creating almost like a fusion, like she was going to weigh 35 pounds. It's like I thought of it like it was a reverse pregnancy. Instead of her mother carrying Jane in her body in preparation for birth, Jane symbolically carried her mother on her body and never wanted to relinquish her. So for both Arlene and Jane, eating becomes a way where they can express their deep hunger for relationship. Now, keep in mind, these are examples I'm using in my books that go to like really deep core conflicts. This is not what most everyday people are dealing with. But I wanted to show you how our unconscious minds can show up in really interesting ways, so that you can be curious about your own experience and start to be a detective of the mind for yourself. Instead of like, you know, why am I doing this? What's going on with me? Tried to find in food what they could not find in their mothers. Only by working through the painful relationships of the past and realizing how they kind of had identified with their mothers and reenacted their trauma, their traumatic relationships, did they begin to heal the wounds of the past. Arlene stopped eating donuts of any kind. Actually, she could just have a donut. Like if she wanted one, she could have one. And a lot of times she didn't want one. But she could have a donut and it wouldn't be this thing where she would, you know, eat 13 of them crying and feeling desperate and in horrible pain emotionally and physically. And Jane could lose the weight and never actually gained 135 pounds and then lost weight and was like a normal healthy weight. Because when we really understand why we're binging instead of focusing on what we're eating, and when we accept ourselves and work through the past and are kinder to ourselves, we break free from binge eating for good. For good. These people who were so desperate, Arlene eating 13 donuts at a sitting, 13 donuts. And she felt sick. Of course she felt sick, but she couldn't stop. Jane, who was eating so much that like it was like she was literally growing before my eyes, and she would eat so much it was just killing her. She changed her relationship to food completely. Both of them ended up eating normally. You really can go from feeling powerless and helpless over food to eating normally. When you figure out why you're focusing on what responding to yourself, which is the key, then everything changes for good. It changes for good. So Kennedy, and for anyone else who has that question, I hope that answers your question. I also want to say something about trauma, because I talk about this a lot, but I keep getting questions about this a lot. And so I think it bears repeating, as does everything. This is a repetitive process. Some things you just can't hear enough. So trauma. When we talk about trauma, a lot of times people will say to me, well, I wasn't traumatized. Like nothing terrible happened to me. I wasn't in some terrible fatal car accident where my family died and I lived, or, you know, I wasn't like molested, or, you know, nothing terrible happened to me. And I tell them, yeah, big, 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 big T traumas. And that's like a big, you know, butcher knife to your chest, like one big, terrible, awful thing that happens. But most trauma is what's called little T trauma. So we have the butcher knife to your heart, and then we have 1,000 small cuts, 1,000 cutting remarks, 1,000 put downs, 1,000 or more than 1,000, you know, all of those times that people say disparaging things to you, mock you, cut you down, make you feel bad about yourself, those are painful and cutting. And it doesn't even have to be big. It could be something even smaller, and it doesn't have to be like a mean cutting remark that's super harsh. Think about it. You were bullied. Oh, don't think about it. Ignore them. Like, that doesn't sound traumatic, but what's the message? The message is, hey, how you feel doesn't matter. You should be able to let go of how you feel and just ignore someone who's bullying you. And we, the people who are telling you, we don't really care about how you feel. We just want you to get over it. That's traumatic when it happens over and over and over and over. And so we learn how to respond to ourselves by the way that we are treated. And if you experience that kind of little t trauma, 1,000 small cuts, pay attention to the ways in which you are treating yourself that way. Because if you're dismissive to yourself, you can't drop a feeling. You can't let it go. You can't positive think it away. You can't ignore it. And by the way, there's some idea that if you just sit in your feelings, they'll somehow go away. Like, I don't even understand how that's supposed to be a thing. But no, the only way to get rid of feelings is to feel them, to express them, and also to respond to ourselves when we feel them. When we do that, we don't need food to escape, to comfort, to express, or for any other reason. So that's just something really important to think about. Like, what are your traumas? What are the hurts and the pains that were inflicted on you? Sometimes without meaning to, you know, like people will say, you fell down, like, to their kid. You fell. Oh, you're okay. Get up. Those boys, like, okay, that the kid fell down and is hurting, you know. And then we do that to ourselves. We have physical or emotional pain. Talking about how we translate to emotional pain. It's like, no, we're okay. I'm okay. I'm gonna fight through this. No, your feelings need your attention, not your condemnation. And when you take care of your feelings, when you take care of yourself, and when you respond to yourself and express what you're feeling, and when you're a friend to yourself, all of these behaviors that are designed to take you away from these feelings, they go away. That's how you break free from binging. Yes, it is easier said than done, but it is possible. I am living proof. Everyone in my books is living proof. There is hope. Okay. Thank you so much for joining me today here on the Dr. Nina Show on LA Talk Radio and live on Instagram. I am here live every Wednesday at 11 a.m. Pacific, and you can also listen later on the Dr. Nina Show on LA Talk Radio on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get podcasts. And if you like the show, please do me a huge favor and go to Apple Podcasts and leave a rating and a review, because the more reviews and ratings that I get, the more I show up in searches and the more I can help people. And that is my goal. So stay curious, not critical. I'll see you next week. Bye for now.
You're listening to the Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle-Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.